Welcome to the Lost Together podcast with Matt Wardlaw.
This week, our guest is Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket. Glenn joins us for a lengthy conversation regarding the 25th anniversary of Toad's Fear album, and he also had plenty of details to share regarding his forthcoming new solo album, Swallowed by the New, which is going to be out in October. You can pre-order Glenn's new solo record right now via his website at glennphillips.com and also digitally via Bandcamp. I'll put links for those pre-order options in the show notes for this podcast. Toad the Wet Sprocket is about to hit the road for the second leg of their summer tour, which features them performing the full Fear album at select shows. The tour resumes on August 12th in Charlotte, and they're going to be on the road at this point through the early fall, with shows booked through September, with a handful of dates booked in October as well. We had a great chat about the 25th anniversary of the Fear album, which was album number 3 for Toad the Wet Sprocket, and the one that really broke things wide open for the group. They scored 2 top 20 hits on the Billboard charts with All I Want and Walk on the Ocean, and the album itself went platinum. Consider this, Glenn was not even 21 at the time that the album was being made, so he really got thrown into the music industry machine at an early age, which is something that he discusses extensively during our conversation today. It was a really enjoyable chat with Glenn, and I think you all dig it. Visit Glenn online at glennphillips.com and toadthewetsprocket.com. I should mention that they are selling some really cool merchandise that commemorates that 25th anniversary. So if you can't make it to the show, you can order that stuff online at the Toad website. But it's been going quickly, so move fast on that, and hopefully you can make it out to a show. Because if you are going to a show this summer, Glenn's going to have copies of his new record for sale early, exclusively at the merch stand, which is a great way to get your hands on it before it officially goes on sale to the masses on October 7th. So many choices, all of them good. Hopefully you can make it out to a show. All the tour dates are up on the band's website, and you can find Glenn's solo dates on his website. Thanks again for checking out the Lost Together podcast. Visit losttogetherpod.com, where you can subscribe via iTunes, RSS, and also find an episode archive. Email me at losttogetherpod@gmail.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at losttogetherpod. Now let's get into today's interview with Glenn.
This summer, Toad the Wet Sprocket going on the road, celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Fear album, which is pretty incredible. And I wondered what comes to mind for you when you look back at the experience of making that record.
Mostly that it was a really long time ago. I mean, it's bizarre to think of it because, you know, my oldest daughter is, God, my middle daughter is older than I was when we recorded that record.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I was, or maybe, you know, actually, it was, you know, 1920 when we were writing and recording that. And it's just, it's bizarre to think how long ago that was and kind of how much has changed in my life and my perspective and, yeah, so it's a really bizarre thing to look at. I mean, the thing that hits me the most is how those themes come back.
Yeah.
That there was, you know, this idea of hanging on to idealism. You know, the Toad as, you know, as a young band was on the broody side of things. You know, it wasn't songs about like understanding everything, and it was more like it was a pretty vulnerable record. And I look at those themes now, and I kind of think of, you know, you go into your 20s saying, I'm gonna be the first person to hold on to all my idealism, and you go out and you live for a few years, and at some point, you know, you lose your idealism and go into kind of survival and family mode. And now I'm finding myself, you know, kind of looking at reclaiming some of that idealism and kind of bringing my life in line with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a different process in your 40s. You go, hey, wait a second. I didn't know a damn thing when I was 19, but I kind of maybe lived a little more in integrity with who I was. And, you know, in your 40s, it's like, I think I want to give a damn what other people think a little less and, like, do things the way I want to now. So, you know, it's interesting how that all kind of turns around.
Well, and I mean, the major label music industry fishbowl has to be a really interesting place to be at like 19 and 20 years old. I mean, you know, as you guys made that initial run of records, I mean, you were, you know, kind of, you know, growing up in the music industry.
Yeah, it was a strange place to grow up, and not a place that we never took it too seriously. I kind of thought when it was happening that it was going to be, you know, a hilarious little story to tell. And then it just kept continuing. And, you know, we kept making a living as musicians. And that was unexpected. I think it's the best way to describe it. And I also, I don't know, there's musicians. I know some people who kind of maybe, you know, needed to be in that world. And that was their biggest dream. And I always knew that I didn't have thick enough skin for that. I always kind of had the idea that that world was a little too exposed for me. And so being there anyway, it was a really odd experience. I always felt a little uncomfortable. I felt a little too vulnerable being that visible. It was a very strange experience, and it gives you a really poor idea of what reality actually is, because you also start kind of thinking, I guess whatever I do, people will just like it, and it'll be a success. And once the major labels fell apart a little more, and the business changed so dramatically, and I mean, you know, it's odd to go from that to very quickly after the band breakup being like, can I get a record deal?
Yeah.
Nobody wants to work with me. What happened? And the part of me that had, imposter syndrome at the beginning, the part that felt like, I'm going to get caught. They'll figure out I'm just faking it. And they'll kick me out of this in an instant. Like, that part of me went a little crazy for a while. I was like, see, you weren't supposed to be there. You didn't deserve it. It was just a setup to remind you that this is not your place. So, weird stuff.
Well, this was the first proper album that you guys were recording for Columbia Records. What was that part of the process like, having a major label in the mix for that third record?
The weird thing about it was they gave us total freedom.
Wow.
They were... our A&R guy was this guy, Ron Oberman. And he was really happy to let us do what we felt we wanted to do. When we signed with Columbia, part of our thing with them, you know, because we thought, you know, it was just, you know, from where we grew up, we thought we were like a very indie band, right? And it was just when indie bands were starting to sign onto major labels. We already had 2 albums done, and we were pretty full of ourselves. And so we insisted on creative control. And so when we went in, like, we were working, you know, we chose the producer. Gavin McKillop had done, you know, Hunters and Collectors and Shriek Back and...
The Church.
The Church. So, I mean, we chose him not for pop hittery, but for, because he was a really cool indie producer. And,
yeah.
And, you know, we wanted to make a big record. My favorite records at the time were, you know, Talk Talk, the later Talk Talk records, like Laughing Stock. And, you know, it was really into Peter Gabriel. And, you know, we wanted to make a big record in that way. You know, something that was really textured and interesting. And they let us go in and make whatever record we wanted. And, you know, as proof of how little pop pressure we had, you know, All I Want, which was the big breakthrough single, which everybody in retrospect was like, oh, yeah, I could see that a mile away. you know, it was almost didn't make the record because we thought it was too pop. I mean, Good Intentions, which ended up being a hit later, didn't make the record because it was too pop. and that was, I think, the third single, like 9 months into the record.
Wow.
So it wasn't like we, you know, came out swinging and went for the charts. It's we thought we were an indie band, and we were making a record accordingly. So it was kind of great. I mean, the only bummer for me was that I wasn't 21 yet. We recorded it in Reno, and so the rest of the band got to run off and go to the go to the casino. So I just had to sit back and wait.
Yeah, I was going to ask, was there any special significance to where you guys ended up recording there in Reno, Nevada, Granny's place?
The main reason was they had an SSL, they had a mean sidecar, so they had the boards that Gavin liked working on, they had 48-track scooters, and it was 48-track analog, right? So they had, you know, the right tape machines and the gear to link them up, and we wanted to do 48. We wanted to, you know, so they had all the gear. They had a great day rate, and we wanted to go somewhere where we could, you know, live, eat, you know, a residential studio where we could just totally immerse ourselves in the project. You know, so we were working 14-hour days every day, and it was incredibly fun.
And it seems like you guys were pretty well fixed for material from what I've heard. I mean, you mentioned Good Intentions getting left off the record, but I've heard that there was like even more stuff than that that didn't make the record.
Yeah, we were pretty prolific back then. And I forget how many. We probably recorded 18 songs or something.
Yeah.
18, 19 songs. And yeah, whittled it down and tried to make, you know, tried to make the record work as a record. The idea was have too much material and then you can chop it down to the album that works.
It's kind of interesting looking when you talk about, like, say, All I Want getting almost left off for being too pop, and you leave Good Intentions off for that same reason. Like, if you're quarterbacking it now, it's almost kind of the reverse. It's almost really kind of surprising that All I Want didn't get left off the record, if that's what you guys were concerned about.
Yeah, we felt it was a good moment. I mean, it's, what, the ninth track or something? We didn't, like, stick it first.
Yeah.
I don't think we thought it would be a single. I mean, once again, I don't think we thought we were going to end up being a top 40 band.
Mm-hmm.
That was just not in the, the game plan. But yeah, it all turned out well. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, I have a lot of friends who never had the single, and who had, you know, what happened is you get the single and then you lose your indie cred.
Yeah.
It kind of comes with it. And we had indie cred before that. And when we had a single, when we were on the radio in top 40, I think if you come from, at that time, if you came from the indie world, all of a sudden you would become a little bit of a whipping boy. And it's just not the case anymore. I mean, that's the strangest bit. It's such a different world now. I mean, I think I always, like, think of Jose Gonzalez as this person who is, you know, has this amazing credibility, right? If there is ever an NPR and press-friendly artist, like, you look at Jose Gonzalez and you go, okay, that guy's unimpeachable. And he got his notoriety. He got his biggest exposure through a Sony Bravia commercial at the beginning, right, with the cover of Heartbeats.
Yeah.
And so you're sitting there going, okay, how does the world change enough that, like, you can be broken on a commercial for high definition televisions and still have credibility? I mean, it's just a very, very different world than it was when we were there. Like, you know, we would never do an advertisement. Like, that would be the biggest sellout, even being on the radio. And you think of, like, you know, Pearl Jam and Counting Crows, like, either not playing their big single at their concerts, or like disfiguring it horribly.
Yeah.
You know, there's this whole thing of kind of hating your own success that was part of the 90s. It was just a big pain in the ass. And nobody has that anymore. It's like, thank goodness everybody is over that, because it really gets in the way.
Do you feel like you guys ran up against that?
Absolutely. We were, you know, because we wanted to be an indie band. We were like, I was wanting credit for my Crafts records, right?
Right.
I didn't want to, you know, and I was feeling like, hey, yeah, we're doing mellow music. Yeah, we're not doing, like, screamingly loud shit. But we actually, you know, there was also a thing at that time of bands would get a lot of criticism. We got a lot of criticism for not being heavier, as if we hadn't made a choice in the kind of music we played. I mean, it's just weird. Do you not think we could turn on our distortion pedals more if we wanted to? You don't think we know that there's that option there? you know, it was a weird time. But it took Elliot Smith, I think, to make it okay to be beautiful and be considered heavy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or not necessarily heavy, but deathful, right? Before Elliot Smith, you either had to be kind of heavy, you know, I don't know. It was just this attitude that was kind of anti-beauty. And we were a little more sensitive, and it was kind of before geek culture took off, and I think, or nerd culture, more accurately. And, you know, we were more from the nerd set, and then we got our name from a Monty Python sketch. You know, it's like, it was just an interesting time because everybody was trying so hard to be edgy. And at the same time, they were getting signed on major labels and having singles and then running away from their own success. You know, Pearl Jam to me is just the best example of that. As a band that couldn't, that was really, really uncomfortable being super successful.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. I mean, it just was. I mean, you talk about, like, you know, bands and artists now, like, maybe breaking and going viral from, like, a television commercial or from a YouTube thing. I mean, you guys were in kind of an equally interesting position in a different way with, like, you know, the bands and stuff that were happening on alternative radio. Like, it's just, it's been really interesting when you put 25 years on to, like, see kind of what, how the improbable success happens today compared to how it happened for you guys. Like, I mean, there's always like a different angle that like shines the light on somebody. And now maybe it's a television commercial, but like, as you said, back in the day, like, I mean, the one that comes to mind, you know, I think about like, Joe Satriani having Summer Song in, I think, the Sony commercial. And that was a big game changer for him as an artist, but you didn't see a lot of that back then.
No. I mean, I think it could happen, and you had to be willing, because it was not, it was not smiled on. And press broke records, and if press thought you'd sold out, you were screwed.
Yeah.
And the fact was, we were not, you know, I feel like we have, now in retrospect, we have some appreciation. But even now, you know, when we put out a new record, it's like there still hasn't been the major music magazine that has had a, you know what, Toad was actually pretty good article. Still right. Hasn't been written. It's still kind of, you know, a very small subset of people who are willing to say we were a pretty good band. but it's, you know, we're the guilty pleasure. It's like, we're a guilty pleasure, whatever. But yeah, that era, it was a very different world. And I mean, the thing that we benefited from was having, you know, at the time we came out, it was just before computers. It was just before you could burn a CD. CDs were brand new. Record companies had a shit ton of money because people were buying a cassette, a CD, and possibly also a vinyl album. if they really liked a record, right? So album sales were alive and well. They had tons of cash on hand. And when Donny Einer signed us to Columbia, he signed us and, you know, said he signed us and Toy Dog Pondering, and their press conferences about those signings were that they were showing that they could understand college music and that they could do artist development. And that they were signing us with this commitment of multi-album long-term artist development. So they released the first two records, Bread and Circus and Tale, our two indie records. They released them as is, untouched. They let us have complete creative control. They kept us on the road for 9 months. And before All I Want came out, that was going to be the end of the record. Like, the discussion was, yeah, it's been 9 months, you toured, it did pretty well, let's do another record. Like, we... And then we got a single, and then we went on tour for another 9 months. You know, we did 300 shows for that record. And so the fact that the record company was so patient and so willing to stand behind us for so long, like, that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of having 9 months and having a company willing to do another single at that point is crazy. So, I mean, there was a blip of history, and we also ended up being at a time when they'd just done some of the major FCC deregulation.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't even alternative radio. At the beginning of that record, alternative radio did not exist. And people were talking, like, I just remember the charts were changing their names all the time. Is it postmodern? Is it, you know, there was like the college music chart, and then there was postmodern chart, and you know, they're trying to figure out what to call it, and it wasn't even called alternative yet, you know? And so we were getting played in the postmodern, we were getting played on rock radio, we were getting played on Top 40, because all of a sudden the big radio conglomerates, like, it was changing. Formats were open, people were selling radio stations, they were experimenting with formats, and we were this weird music that wasn't like as pop as pop. We weren't kind of as heavy as some of the other rock or alternative music. Like, we, in the same way we didn't particularly fit any genre, we were great for an area where genres were less defined. And I mean, all of those things, like, if they hadn't all happened at the same time, nobody ever would have heard us. And so we really got lucky.
For sure. Yeah, totally. And you know what's interesting, looking at the initial, like, five records that you guys put out, like, a lot of times, like, when a band, like, say, goes their separate ways or whatever at the end of that last record in the cycle, you can kind of see that, like, you know, oh, you know, hearing that last record, it was kind of a dud. I can kind of see why they fell apart. But that really didn't happen with you guys. Like, you guys were kind of the rare breed in that time period that, like, you look at the five records that you guys put out, they were all solid records.
Thank you. Well, and I think the next record would have been the record, which is why we didn't make it. We kind of couldn't get on the same team when we tried to follow up Coil. And that's why we pulled the plug.
Well, you guys are going to be playing the full Fear record at some shows this summer. And are there songs, like, there's a good number of songs that have continued to make their way into the live set from this record. But are there songs that you guys haven't played either ever or in a long, long time from this record?
There's some. We never played Prayer Gods live.
Yeah.
Just the kind of two, or, you know, the production of it and the feel of it was hard to do in a live context. I'm sure there's a few others. We didn't play, I don't know, In My Ear very much. And at some point we stopped playing Hold Her Down, which came more for me just because it's a hard song to play. It's, you know, just emotionally, it's really difficult to be inside that material.
Yeah.
And draining and and not everybody got it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, both from the point of view, I mean, it's a song that it, and on the one hand, it, I think it's really appropriate that we're bringing it out again this year because, I mean, with Stanford, with even Gamergate, like this kind of new rape culture.
Yeah.
And the new open discussion about sexual assault and what it means, it's very alive right now. So I think it's a very appropriate time for that conversation to be back. But that song was written in such a way that it kind of places you in the middle of this kind of confusion and rage, and it's supposed to be really unpleasant. And I mean, the song came out of this realization that every single woman I knew had been sexually assaulted. And, you know, there was this year of just finding out, like, one by one by one, like, holy crap, and finding out how much was unreported and how much these women had to just take on their own of that burden. And, you know, and so looking again at that song, you know, and seeing where it's misunderstood, because it's so much in the middle, you know, occasionally a woman would misunderstand it and accuse us of supporting rape culture, and that really hurt.
Oh, yeah.
And then occasionally there would be some frat dude in the audience yelling, "Play Holder Down!" And that just made me sick to my stomach.
Oh, and, understandably.
Yeah, and so that song's really hard to play. But we're doing that again. And, you know, and once again, I think the ability to reference back to the fact that we've not come that far. We've not come as far as we should have. But I also do hope that, you know, as much as, you know, the internet has, I think, enabled a certain amount of rape culture, a certain amount of misogyny, mm-hmm. it also kind of helps bring it to light. And I think sometimes these things need to come to light before they die their deserved deaths. I mean, in the same way, I don't know, in the same way, I feel like having a black president emboldened racists.
Oh, absolutely.
Who were able to say, hey, we're now in a post-racial society, so my ideas aren't, my racist ideas aren't racist anymore. And they all kind of came out from under their rocks and showed their true colors. And, I mean, in the same way with homophobia, it's like, it's been this thing that as we become more egalitarian, as we become freer, as we become more tolerant and more inclusive, those who are filled with hate reveal themselves, and reveal themselves in really blatant ways. And it's a painful process, but I think it's also a really useful one. So that's the thing to keep in mind, is the fact that it's more visible now doesn't necessarily mean there's more of it. It means that it's a public discussion now. And I think it used to be there, and it used to not be talked about, and it used to be something that was shameful and hidden. And now, even though, you know, those idiots are emboldened, means we can see them in the light of day, and I think that's important.
Well, to wrap up the Toad side of things, I wanted to ask, what else is on tap for the band? I mean, is there any new music on the Toad horizon?
Nope.
Okay.
Not right now.
I mean, Architect of the Ruin was a nice surprise, cool little bit of new music to get last year from you guys leading into the summer's touring. That was nice to see that one come around on the heels of the last record.
Thank you, yeah. And that song in particular, I mean, once again, we'd recorded more songs than we needed for New Constellation. So four of the songs on that EP were outtakes from the record.
Right.
And two of them, Sunny and Architect of the Ruin, were new. And Architect really dovetails into the solo record as well, just as far as the material I was working with, you know, personally, yeah, and how to kind of, yeah, write about all that.
Yeah, and I wondered about that. That was the song I was asking about specifically, because it does seem like it ties in thematically to where you've gone with this new solo record. So I didn't know if that was coincidental or if there was a link, because it seemed like there was a link.
Yeah, no, it was what was in the air.
Yeah. No. Leaving Old Town is the first song that I heard from this record in February of last year when you played it live. I mean, it was a pretty heart-wrenching sampling that gave a good example of where things might be headed with this record. And I wondered, is that the first song that you wrote for this record? Where did things kind of start out for this record?
It's one of the first ones I wrote. I had been trying not to write a breakup record.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to do too much crying in my beer.
Mm-hmm.
Figured I was going through enough of that. I wanted to do something positive and buoyant. And the fact is that songs are how I process my life. So I was in a songwriting group. There's a guy, Map the Electrician, who's in Texas, is a really great indie songwriter. And he does, he leads a group that does this game that Bob Schneider invented, where you can do it if you're on tour. You can do it on a daily basis, but Matt's group does it on a weekly basis. And basically, he sends out a song title, and 20 or so songwriters all write a song based on that title, that theme, kind of using it as a jumping-off point. And I had been wanting to kind of get back in shape and have, you know, somebody to answer to, and I thought it, you know, I'd done stuff like that before, so I thought it would be a really good exercise to join that group and, you know, have a song to write every week, right? And but the titles that he kept sending were kind of exactly the songs that I was trying not to write, and
oh, wow.
I hadn't written a song in a while, and I think the first title was Reconstructing the Diary, and you know, I was, and so that song, and to some degree, like that song, I'm happy I wrote it because I feel like it, it got me out of a writer's block. And it was, you know, it's a little bit cutesy, and it's a little bit on the self-pity train, but it took out the stopper that enabled me to start writing and even realize I didn't have to take it so seriously. It didn't have to all be about trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first songs written for the album, as it turns out, were, you know, Reconstructing the Diary, My Criminal Career, and Leaving Old Town. And those are all from Matt the Electrician's songwriting group.
Wow.
Titles just kept over and over being, they just kept being really good breakup song titles.
And Reconstructing the Diary, that's a short song, you know, it's kind of the coda of the record. Did you kind of envision it that way? Was it kind of a conscious decision to like make it a shorter song and kind of stop where it does?
It's just how it came out. I wrote it. It probably took less than an hour to write. I was sitting at that point. I hadn't moved out of the house yet. I was, had a studio in the garage and was sleeping out there. Got up in the morning, looked at the email, picked up the ukulele, and had the song finished in about an hour. And I remember talking to my now former spouse. You know, she walked in the garage and I said, "Hey, listen, I wrote a song," and played that for her. And she had this really sad look on her face. And I realized, like, oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Like, but I was so happy because I hadn't been writing. I had total writer's block. And that song was the one that kind of got me off the edge. And so in a way, I feel there's a progression through the writing. Those three songs are the most maybe wistful about the relationship, And they're probably the most self-pitying on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the record, it's about, you know, it's less about divorce and more about the process of facing transition and embracing transition. And I think we have a culture that's not, we don't have a really great tool set for that. We like to blame, and we like to hold on to our resentments. And there's, I think, part of that American frontier idea is that if something doesn't work, you leave it behind and you find something better. That didn't work because it wasn't good enough for you. Rather than asking, like, what we could learn, or maybe if we had something to do with why things didn't work, you know, these kind of more basic questions, or even whether it worked perfectly and ended when it needed to, right? To enable you to do your next work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's so, there was a bit of unraveling from feeling victimized by the change that was happening to me and to starting to feel grateful for it. And it's strange for me to look at this record now because I did it a year ago and I did it at a time when I was having to really fight for hope, because I was still extremely resistant to the change in my life. I was still kind of being consumed by shitty thoughts.
Yeah.
And, you know, going through a divorce after 25 years, it's like I thought all the terrible thoughts that everybody thinks in that situation. And there's a question of whether you choose to believe in those thoughts or not. And I met a lot of people who doubled down on hate or blame or bitterness. And I really did not want to be that because I felt like if I took that road, I knew it would not end anyplace good. And so it's interesting looking back, and I'm sitting in a place now where I can honestly say I'm happier than I've been in a decade. Like, I'm more excited about my choices. I'm more excited about my day-to-day reality. I feel like I was given a great gift. And it's not a gift I would have chosen or asked for. It's not a gift I would not have been brave enough to say that my marriage wasn't working. And I used to be really angry that she was the one to be brave enough to say it wasn't working.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time resenting her for that. And I remember this January calling my ex and saying, like, thank you so much. I would never have been brave enough. I would never have stepped out enough to say we need to do something different. And as much as I held it against her for so long, all I can do is thank her now because she's freed both of us. We're both so much happier. We can be friends, we can be supportive of each other, and we can move on. And it took so much guts to do that. And, you know, Louis C.K. has the whole thing about it, right? It's like, why do people say I'm sorry? Like, you say you're divorced, and they say I'm sorry. And it's like, you never get divorced because it's working really well, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In any event. So I've been, it's just looking at this record, I can see it as these series of tools. And I feel good about where I was trying to aim, even though I couldn't see it yet. and that there's some songs that are more directly about relationships, and there are a lot more songs that are about facing the unknown and about facing the difficult questions and about not losing yourself to blame or self-hatred or, you know, or anger or any of those traps.
Well, you talked about how it helps you to write songs. Like, that's kind of like, you know, one of your, I guess, mechanisms that's helpful. And I kind of wondered about the aftermath of doing that, the way these songs then become a part of your catalog. You know, what you've put down, in a sense, it's always going to be kind of hanging there in the air going forward. So I wondered, when you were writing songs for what becomes this record, did you find yourself writing any songs, recording any things that were too personal that you just put away on the shelf? Do you do stuff like that?
Too personal? No. I mean, unfortunately, I don't think my job allows me to think in terms of too personal. I think I just have to suck that one up. But in terms of... there were things that were just not true enough, or not, or were true but were a small enough part of me or a shitty enough part of me that I didn't see the need to share them with the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And so there's some really angry, blaming songs I wrote. And I mean, that's why, you know, I almost didn't put Reconstructing the Diary on the record. You know, even a couple days ago, honestly, I was thinking about taking it off and having a new last song.
Mm-hmm.
Because the point of view in that song is something I no longer feel at all. I mean, it's a cute little idea, but it's a little bit of a barb, and it's a little, it's small. But I also feel like it is a cute song. It's reasonably well written, and that part of it is a little document of a moment. Maybe it wasn't the best choice for the end of the record, except that it's a ditty. You know, the songs, I mean, if you want a personal song, it's like, you know, Grief and Praise is a pretty personal song.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I feel like that song is written from the perspective. It's written from a higher perspective. It's written in a way that I'm proud of. It's written in a way that's something I feel like is worthy of sharing with people. And I think is going to be useful to a lot of people. And I mean, that's another thing about this record. It's the first, actually, it's not true, because I think New Constellation has started to really think more about intent. But even to a greater degree on this record, instead of just writing whatever was on my mind and figuring that was my job and, you know, collecting stuff that vaguely fit together and coming up with a unifying theme after the fact, this was the first record where I thought about my intent as I was writing it, and I thought about what the record needed to say, and what kind of a document I wanted to make and what purpose I thought it could have for other people. And so to make something that would be, yeah, useful for people going through transition, whether it's breakups, whether it's death in the family, whatever, you know, major changes that happen to people, losing your job, losing your security, having a medical, you know, in this country, anything medical is a disaster because we have no reasonable medical care system.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, it's fairly universal topics. And I wanted to approach them from an angle that, yeah, it'd been helpful to me, that, you know, included some of the teachers that helped me through my time, you know. And so there's references to, you know, Martine Prechtel and Octavia Butler, and, you know, there's a little bit of science in Baptistina. Martine Prechtel and, you know, who came up with the Grief and Praise concept. There's a book of his called The Smell of Rain on Dusk that's, I think, a really important book on grieving. And, you know, Stephen Jenkinson, who does palliative care, he wrote a book called Die Wise and does palliative care in Ottawa, Canada. he's a phenomenal thinker. And, you know, David White, even at the end of it, like, there are just these writers people kept turning me on to that opened my mind up in ways that really got me through that time. And so, and I've, you know, I'm prone to melancholy, I guess you could say. And, I mean, I was really scared that I would go through this process and not recover, because I can, I've had a long history with depression.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And I'm kind of amazed that I'm here. I'm not taking antidepressants. So I don't know, I'm on an extended manic high, or I've actually done some work. Hopefully I've done some work.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned grief and praise, because, like, when you talk about this record, you know, kind of being a set of tools and, you know, transition related and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I think that's a song that stuck out to me as one that had some pretty important messages within that song.
We were already recording the record, and I had made a list of the things I wanted to say, and the things that in some way were hardest for me to say were unsaid. So, the concept of grief and praise, I mean, like Katie Prechtel, essentially that grief and praise are the mirror of each other, that they're both about the expression of love out loud for the things you'll lose, right? Grief is the things you have lost. Praise is the things you will lose. And how important it is to say that out loud. And I had not directly addressed my kids and the change that they felt in watching their family. I mean, I had two kids go away to college, which is, you know, wonderful, and also it's heartbreaking. As a parent, it's like, you've done everything right. These incredible people who are so capable and brilliant, and then you say goodbye, and they're no longer these faces you see every day, right? It's so hard to do. And then the marriage, and then my youngest daughter, and then, you know, it's like, there's been so much change, and I had not thanked my children and addressed them, and I had not thanked my ex-wife. You know, even at that time when I was still so much in pain, like, she'd given me 25 years of her life, and she's an incredible person, and I had to address that. I couldn't just be addressing my pain and my separation. You know, I knew I needed to say these things, and I knew I needed to talk about that entire process. And that song too, I actually didn't even know that David White had a poem called, It's the Well of Grief, and I had the Well of Sorrow. And I just had this image in my mind that the Well of Sorrow is, you know, connected to the same aquifer that, you know, the joy comes out of, right? That anything that is deeply connected and vulnerable is gotta have, it's all connected. Like, you cannot have deep connection without deep grief. They're not separable. David White actually has some quote, you know, we routinely convince ourselves that that it is possible to love without heartache. And it's not. And so, anyway, for me, that song was just the most important part. And I wrote that 3 days into the recording of the record.
Oh, wow.
It was everything that I hadn't said yet. They were the hardest things to say, honestly. And I recorded that. I wrote it, and we recorded it the next morning. And so, yeah, that was a fresh piece of meat.
Wow, so you really put that one down, you know, pretty soon after you'd written it without a lot of deliberation, and did it kind of stick the way you put it down?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, wow. From a recording standpoint, were there things that you wanted to capture in a certain way to kind of fit the mood of the songs? I mean, like, I just hear, like, say, the sound of the way your vocals were recorded on Go. That was one that stuck out right away, and you can hear a lot of the room sound surrounding the vocal on that one, and similarly, the way your voice is captured on the Easy Ones was another one that kind of stuck out.
Yeah, well, sorry. We recorded it at Paul Bryan's house, and he put some padding in a little closet that was kind of between a bathroom and a laundry room. And as we were recording the vocals, I did say, I think we're going to get a lot of, like, hall sound on these. He was saying, it's fine. It's fine. So that's the hall you're hearing.
Nice.
It is a little hall between a bathroom. And whether that was on purpose or not, I don't think it was generally on purpose, but it was actually just the place I was in.
I mean, it fits the song for Go. I mean, it fits it really well.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the recording of the album, the main thing for me was that I wanted it to be, and Paul as well, the idea was that it should be always supportive of the vocal and the lyric. Like, that was actually the only important part on the record, or at least the most important part is the vocal and the lyric, and getting the emotional truth of the matter all the way through. And so everything was in service to that. And so there's, you know, almost nothing is doubled. The parts are really kind of simple and straightforward. Everything is supposed to push back the emotional truth of the song. And, you know, there are these string parts that Paul arranged, and they're so beautifully put together. I mean, I love his work, and it just seems like everything is in service of the melody and the emotion, and that what we tried to avoid was anything that, you know, said, look at me, I'm fancy, I'm exciting, you know, and so Jay's drumming, you know, Chris and Jevin, who were the guitarist and keyboard player, like, I don't know. I felt like we did a good job of keeping things simple and keeping everything, like, focused in an appropriate way. And I love the harmony vocals on the record. Ruby Ellen Fu did most of the backups. And my daughter, Freya, who's 14, actually sang on the Easy Ones.
Oh, cool.
And my friend Amber Rubarth on There's Always More. Yeah, it was great getting Freya in the studio for that. She's amazing.
And I can't remember which song I heard it. I want to say it might have been Amnesty, but keyboard-wise, was there a Chamberlain? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, there's definitely. Is it a Chamberlain? I think it's a Mellotron.
Okay, yeah. Either way, like, it had a very, like Michael Penn uses that kind of sound, like, all over the records he's made in the past, and it's like, it's just it's a sound you don't hear much on records, so it's cool to hear.
He's got, actually, it's
Patrick Warren.
Patrick Warren is the guy that helped, I think it's like the M400, so it's a newer Mellotron that includes all of the Chamberlain tapes as well. It's like Paul has it's the most mega Mellotron you have ever seen. And so basically the complete tapes from both the Mellotron and the Chamberlain. And we used a lot of that. It's also the oboes. There's a lot of woodwind stuff on the song Unwritten. It's all Chamberlain as well. Mellotron, I guess. And the keyboard player, Jevin Bruni, Jevin and Chris Bruce, the guitar player, both play in Michelle Indigiacello's band. Paul sometimes plays bass for Michelle Indigiacello, which he describes as kind of a harrowing job because, you know, he plays bass if she just wants to sing on a few songs, mm-hmm. but you're never going to play bass as well as Michelle Indigiacello.
Oh, yeah.
So it's always like, hi, I'm the guy who's not playing bass as well as the boss. Like, but you still got to be pretty damn good to get that gig. And then we had Jay Bellarose on the drums, and Jay is amazing. He's so, I don't know, orchestral. He looks at drums in a way that I don't think I've seen anyone else approach them. He has just such a great sideways approach. Like there's the parts that anybody else would play, and he just immediately rejects them and finds something that's completely appropriate and always unexpected.
So it sounds like the record's going to be coming out this fall. How are folks going to get their hand on it? And do you have a hard release date yet, or is that still kind of in the works?
It's going to be October 7th, I believe. It'll be on iTunes and whatever. I actually just got boxes of it in the mail to sell on the Toad Tour, and I'm going out solo as well. And so the best way to get it is to come to a show with Toad.
Nice.
And yeah, but we're not going to do it broadly or in public, so people can pick it up there, and that's kind of a pre-release, and I look forward to, and I think the idea is those will be kind of more hardcore fans, and they can talk about it amongst themselves, and hopefully that chatter will kind of help it when it goes broader. So, yeah.
And I saw that you played at least one solo show back in May at the South Pasadena Eclectic Music Festival with a band. Do you have plans to play mm-hmm. some? Do you have plans to like play some band shows when the record's out, like this fall?
I would love to. As it is right now, I'm going to be touring in Texas with Sean Watkins.
Oh, cool!
From Nickel Creek, and he's going to back me up on some stuff and also open for me. He's got a great new album out. And
yeah, I love
Jonathan
that record.
Kingham, yeah, Jonathan Kingham, who's done a lot of touring with me in the past, is going to come out with me in November. And then New Year, it kind of depends. I hope I can bring a band out. It's honestly a question of whether I can afford to bring a band out.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of funny. I look at, you know, what are my, you know, aspirations for success, and one of them, you know, it's not like wanting to be huge, but I would love to be able to go on the road with a band and actually make a living.
Yeah.
So someday that'll happen, or someday I'll just plan far enough in advance that I can lose a little money for a minute and then go out with the band and do some more. But yeah, I'll be doing a lot of duo touring. I love having somebody to play off of. That's a ton of fun for me to do. So,
well, I guess just wrapping up with a couple things. I wanted to ask, first of all, you mentioned Baptistina, so I mean, just from a title standpoint, that's a very Glenn thing to use a title that ties back to asteroids and dinosaurs. So I thought that was great. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, that's very Glenn.
Yeah. And once again, on the more whimsical side of on the more whimsical side of catastrophic change, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
I thought just, because you never know what's going to happen, right? I mean, you have this giant, horrific mass extinction. And the other fact of it is, without that giant, horrific mass extinction, mammals don't get to take over the planet. And, you know, there would be no us.
Yeah.
So yeah. You never know what's going to come.
Once this record's out, I mean, like, you know, besides the record and you got the tour dates this summer, kind of what else is on tap for you that you want folks to know about?
Let me see. I mean, I don't know what's on tap for me. I'm going to be spending a lot more time in Nashville and kind of, you know, it's just strange. I had this year of kind of licking my wounds and mm-hmm. getting used to my new life. And, you know, in the past 10 months, I've had a new relationship of kind of, you know, found that I'm, you know, enjoying being in love and enjoying, you know, what that brings and that new openness and getting used to that. And, you know, it's been a lot of getting on my feet again and kind of doing it in stages. And so there's a number of projects I want to do. And, you know, there, I've had a lot of uncertainty about kind of where my body would be, just in terms of what place on the planet would I be doing my collaborations.
Yeah.
And so that's finally come a little more into focus, for the next year at least. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of friends I want to collaborate with, and, you know, I having to kind of choose those collaborations partly according to just proximity, like where am I going to be? And so I'm going to be in Nashville a lot more, and so the collaborations are going to focus around people there. And so I've been doing a lot of songwriting and, yeah, have some ideas both for collaborative work and both for future solo work, and we'll see exactly what those are. I don't think I want to let the cat out of the bag with any of them until they're actually happening, because you never know.
But, that makes good sense.
Yeah.
Well, detail-wise, did you record this new record in Nashville?
No, Pacific Palisades. It was a very Los Angeles record.
Interesting. Okay, I wouldn't have guessed that, but that's interesting. Okay. I just knew you'd been spending more time in Nashville, so I when I saw this record, I kind of figured that was kind of where that spawned, so it's interesting to hear that it was still a California thing.
Yeah, I mean, that came out actually of Largo, like so many good things. It's a club in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
I used to play out a lot, and for some reason, I started finding it really hard to go to Los Angeles, and I went down for a Watkins Family Hour show, and I guess Sebastian, who normally plays bass with them, was out on tour, and so Paul Bryan was sitting in on bass and played a couple songs, and he just got in touch with me afterwards and said, I loved your new songs. Do you think maybe we want to talk about maybe doing a record? And, you know, it was perfect that I went down there that night and bumped into him. And, you know, it's strange. It's very easy for, you know, I think it's just a personality thing. I mean, I think there's certain people that's like, you feel isolated and like you have to do everything on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, you can get really good at learning new jobs and taking care of yourself and being really self-reliant. And on the other hand, it can also make you blind and deaf to when people are saying they want to help you. You know, I haven't had personal management for, almost 10 years.
Wow.
And, you know, so I've been doing my own website. I have a booking agent. But, I mean, I got to the point where, you know, I have management again for this record. And it took my old manager, Steve Smith, calling me up and saying, I want to help you. Will you please let me help you? And I finally was like, oh. And my initial response to that is this feeling of going, no, nobody wants to help me. I can do it myself. And it's like, wait a second. Somebody is actively asking you to allow them to help you, and you still won't fucking let them in. Like, that's not healthy. That's not good. So, I mean, I've found in this last year, I mean, it's part of the process of finally allowing myself to trust people, allowing people to come in. I mean, I know it sounds silly, but I'm not the only person who does it, or so I've been told. So trying to rehabilitate myself in that particular respect.
Well, that's cool to hear Steve's back in your world. I saw the show that I think he helped put together last February at the Arc with you and Andrew McMahon and Jonathan and Brett Denon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, from what I know of him, like, he's just a good, positive person that, like, always tries to do good things. So it seems like a good thing to add back into your world.
He's a great guy. And that's the thing about when we stopped working together, it was more because I was heading in a real non-pop direction.
Yeah.
And Aware was heading in a more pop direction. I was with Aware right when John Mayer hit. And, you know, their thing was about making it, you know, their thing switched to being about being big on radio, and it was about having radio hits, and that was a world that I just was not comfortable in at that point. And so, but yeah, that guy, he works his ass off, and he always tells the truth. And not easy to find in the music business.
I was going
to
say, if you find that in the music business, you hold on to that.
Well, and once again, I still stayed at his apartment every time I went to Chicago.
So yeah.
We remained really good friends, but we didn't work together for a while. And it was amazing to just realize, like, oh, let me help you. And kind of, how can I say, the first point in recovery is realizing you have a problem. And hearing him say those words
right.
made me realize that maybe I'd been shutting people out for a while. And, and I mean, same with Paul. It was just like, I kept thinking, like, who wants to work with me? And here's this, like, really brilliant musician, great producer saying, I want to make a record. And it took me months and months to call him and say yes. It's been a good process.
There's our interview with Glenn Phillips of Toe the Wet Sprocket. Hit up his website at glennphillips.com to pre-order his new solo album, Swallowed by the New, which, of course, we talked a lot about during today's podcast. Thanks for listening to the Lost Together podcast. We will be back really soon with our next episode. In the meantime, hit up losttogetherpod.com for an episode archive or email me at losttogetherpod@gmail.com. Have a great day.